Hi, everybody. My name's Mark Zier. I am a graduate of the Pontifical Institute. I worked under Leonard Boyle, and I've been playing with manuscripts ever since. I suppose that's the best way to say it. And so I was very pleased that Chris, you invited me to share in this colloquium today as we explore this text as one of those tools, if nothing else, for preaching and for study that came out of that very prolific period from the, well, middle of the 12th through the end of the 13th century. You might even extend it to the middle of the 14th century, but those of us who like the 13th century think otherwise. The Manipulus Florum of Thomas of Ireland was a remarkably popular text, not only in its day, but for centuries to come, as pithy quotations from mostly sainted authorities have been a stock in trade of preachers from that day to this. The moral life, the life of the church, the life of faith, the themes that are so graphically displayed in that word picture of the Manipulus Florum that you produced on the website. I love that. I wish I could have done the same thing for some of the texts that I have here today, but I didn't get there. Sorry. These themes are ubiquitous in Christian preaching. The Manipulus Florum complemented the kinds of resources such as biblical concordances and collections of distinctiones that had become available to students and preachers over the previous two centuries before Thomas wrote. One of the tools that Thomas had at his disposal, we've been talking about what he had at his disposal, and it's clear that he had at his disposal the Glossed Bible. Here, at a glance, one found a synoptic view of the history of the interpretation of any given text. And while the glosses found there sometimes commented on the historical meaning of the text, more often than not, it was the spiritual meaning, allegorical, moral, anagogical, call it eschatological, whatever. It was the spiritual meaning that was their focus. But the gloss Bibles that Thomas had at his disposal had a couple of limitations. For the most part, the glosses found there were anonymous. And even though anonymous is by far the most common author of the Middle Ages, it just doesn't work when you're looking to give your citations the oomph of authority. Second, the glosses in those Bibles weren't always pithy. So if we're looking for pithy, authoritative quotations, you know. Sometimes they rambled. More often, they were just plain pedestrian. Hence, of the nearly 6,000 citations that Thomas compiled, only some 80 have their source directly in the Glossed Bible. Now, the pattern of the distribution of those 80 citations is at least interesting, if not revealing. The principal books of the Bible that Thomas used, in order of the number of citations, include Matthew with 20 entries, Ecclesiasticus with 17, Proverbs with 11, Psalms with 7, Luke with 4, Mark with 3, Romans with 3, but all from the same verse in Romans 1. And then he also drew on one or two citations from Genesis, Exodus, 2 Chronicles, Esther, Tobit, the Canticle, Job, Isaiah, Malachi, and then in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, 1 Timothy, Hebrews, and James. These books represent only a third of the canon of the Christian Bible. One presumes the rest of the canon was either too boring, dangerous, wacky, obscure, depressing, or serious to yield useful, pithy, moral aphorisms. One will note that there are no citations from glosses on the Gospel of John, or the Apocalypse, or from Numbers, Leviticus, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, or even Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiasticus, but not Ecclesiastes. We knew that Thomas worked at the collegium founded by Robert of Sorbonne, whose purpose was to provide for indigent clerics while they received their theological education. Its library quickly became a repository for a vast array of biblical and theological texts. Among them, the collection eventually received some 136 manuscripts of glossed books of the Bible, a not inconsiderable number. Of course, the collection included many other manuscripts of theological and classical texts. Thomas could hardly have been in a more propitious place to do the work that he set out to do in the Manipulus Florum. Of the 80-some citations from the gloss found in the Manipulus, Thomas gives specific attribution to 69 of them, 69 out of 80, either to Augustine, Jerome, Rabanus, Chrysostom, or Bede, mostly those. The Rusch text of the Gloss Ordinaria, which is the standard reference point for working on the gloss these days, by contrast, the Rusch text gives only a handful of attributions to authorities. Now, I've had a look at I've been looking fairly closely at some 40 or so, roughly half of the 80 citations, and Thomas identifies authorities for 33 of these entries, but the Rusch text only gives 3. So something's going on here. How to account for this? It is not likely that Thomas simply fabricated the attributions. It seems more likely that either he tracked down the authorities himself, a not impossible scenario at the Sorbonne, retaining in his work, then, the text from the glossed Bible rather than that of the original, or he had access to glossed Bible manuscripts in which the authorities had already been identified, which is a rather unlikely scenario given the nature of glossed Bible manuscripts, or he had access to an intermediate work such as that of Hugh of Saint-Cher, whose editorial team had already done this kind of legwork. Either that or he had his own raft of research assistants to help him. This third possibility is intriguing, but I have not had a chance to explore it at this point. In any case, it is clear that establishing authorities was an important part of the work, since the whole point was to collect excerpts from authorities. And the gloss was an anonymous text. I mean, you know, it was a compilation too, in a sense, and it was not in itself an authority. There's much less of a question, in fact, no question at all, concerning how Thomas went about editing his entries that he took from the gloss Bibles. And generally simply copied the gloss as he found it. But under certain circumstances, he edited what he found in the manuscript. In this regard, one of his techniques or one of his methods was to suppress any further citations from the Bible, which were frequently tagged on to the gloss being quoted. So oftentimes in the Gloss Ordinaria, you'll have a quotation, and then at the end, whence, you know, unde, and then a citation of a biblical text. When he was confronted with that, he dropped it. After all, he's looking for authorities other than the Bible for this Manipulus Florum. Every once in a while, he breaks that rule, but very, very rarely. Second, he might either combine glosses for an entry or split a single gloss among several entries, as he does with his other sources. And this may be a result of Thomas's decision, or again, it may have been done for him already in the manuscripts he consulted. And we'll have some examples of that in a minute. Third, he made it a point only to excerpt the text of the gloss that focused on the theme of the topic to which it applies. Again, as I said earlier, sometimes these glosses, while they are often condensations of larger works, even larger passages, longer passages, they can still be kind of rambling and touch on a number of topics. And so Thomas would seem to have been clear about picking out the piece of the gloss that would work for the theme that he was looking at, that he wanted to use it for. Now, while the editor of the Manipulus Forum has helpfully given the text of glosses as they are found in the 1480 Rus edition of what came to be called the Glossa Ordinaria, and that tells us quite a lot already, a more thorough exploration of Thomas's methods requires an examination of manuscripts of the Gloss Bibles. Unfortunately, I've not been able to consult any of those 136 manuscripts from the Sorbonne collection. They're in Paris. However, I have looked at a handful of manuscripts from the Abbey of St. Victor from the 12th and 13th centuries that would have been probably comparable, roughly comparable, certainly to many of the manuscripts found in the Sorbonne. Of these St. Victor manuscripts, these include two that contained the Glossed Ecclesiasticus. One has a complete text, the other is, complete enough. And three manuscripts that contained the Glossed Letters of Paul. And two of those are complete, one is incomplete. That same incomplete, the manuscript that contains the incomplete Letters of Paul also contains an incomplete Gospel of Matthew, Glossed Gospel of Matthew. But it's so incomplete, it's not much use. Now, I am going to want to pass some things out now. Although I have to grab some more papers today. This is just, this isn't one of the copies that I'm going to send around here, but in terms of the example of dropping biblical tags, we can find that in Presumptio D. The text of the gloss at Ecclesiasticus 7.5, which is the heart of this item, it ends with quotations from Ecclesiastes and from Proverbs, but both of these citations are included in not only in the Rus text but also in the manuscripts that I was able to consult, both manuscripts. But they are both omitted in the Manipulus Forum. A second example of this pattern occurs in Doctrina Sive Doctor L. The text of the gloss at Ecclesiasticus 42:8 used here ends with a citation from 1 Timothy. And again, it's a tag that can be found both in Rus and in the manuscript, but it has been suppressed in the Manipulus Forum. In Curiositas AD, the first part of the gloss at Ecclesiasticus 3:24, which contains another citation from Ecclesiastes, is found in Rus and the manuscripts, but has been omitted in the Manipulus Forum. Now, so that's a fairly standard pattern, and probably doesn't need any more comment than that. More common are the instances where Thomas has excerpted the gloss as he has found it in his source to keep the focus on the topic at hand. In Honor P1, he cites the second part of a gloss at Ecclesiasticus 33:18 that gives a simple two-sentence opinion describing the downside of losing one's authority and the upside of keeping it. The first part of the gloss, lacking in the Manipulus Florum, but present in Rusch and the manuscripts, speaks to the necessity of being fair and open with one's judgments, lest chaos ensue. Now, it's a good lead-in to the second part of the gloss, but it destroys the pithiness of the saying, and I think that's why Thomas probably deleted it. The patterns that we've seen in the preceding examples also apply to the entries that draw on the glossed books of Paul, but with a twist. It seems that there is frequently a considerable discrepancy between the text of the glosses found in the Rusch edition and that of those found in the manuscripts. And in this case, there have been the three manuscripts that I've consulted from St. Victor. Generally, this means that most of what is found in the Manipulus Florum is from Rusch, or can be found in the Rusch text. Let's not say that it is from Rusch, since after all, Rusch is much later. But it's found in the Rusch text, but it's missing from the manuscripts. How can this be, you might ask? The short answer is because of Peter Lombard. The Lombard's collectanea in the Epistles of St. Paul, was a major and influential commentary on the Apostle, so much so that it became known as the Magna Glossatura, to distinguish it from the gloss that derived from the school of Anselm of Laon. The Lombard's work is clearly and carefully organized in four parts. After citing a passage of several verses, he begins by reading the text with a continuous commentary. This commentary is, in fact, the Anselmian gloss, that is to say, that gloss that is disposed in the margins and between the lines of the biblical text. He's just simply reading along and reading the gloss as he comes to it. And it's reported and recorded in the collectanea as continuous, right? Following this rehearsal of the amplified text, he adds additional exegetical material. And then occasionally he includes questiones that later become the core of his four books of sentences. The gloss on the letters of Paul, published by Rusch, contains that second part of Lombard's work, that is to say, that section where he adds exegetical material, drawing from various patristic sources usually. Now, as a result, except for the briefer comments, perhaps as much as half of the material found in the Rusch edition of the gloss on Paul's letters, especially the marginal glosses, as much as half comes from Peter Lombard. That means that oftentimes the text of the Manipulus Florum comes not so much from the earlier gloss, but from the later expanded Lombardian gloss. But not always. Romans 1:29 gives a list of evils that arise from turning away from God. These include, to use Thomas's headings, Militia B, Discordia E, and Murmur G. Paul's list includes many more than these three, but in any case, the same brief glosses appear in the manuscripts and in Lombard and in Rusch. Now, interestingly, in the earliest of the manuscripts, they are separated out as individual glosses, but in the other two manuscripts, and as in Rusch, several are consolidated into a single gloss. Now, if I No, I'm not doing that. Okay. Now, Virginitas L. excerpts a gloss found at 1 Corinthians 7:26 in the Rush edition. In this case, the text of the Manipulus Florum comes from the middle of the Rush text, or corresponds to the middle of the Rush text. The Rush text itself begins with a brief text found in two of the manuscripts, adding a further comment that leads into the excerpt found in the Manipulus Florum, and continues beyond the text of the Manipulus Florum with a rather lofty and flowery comment. This has to do with this is all about virginity, right, and virgins. But the issue that the gloss ordinaria, or the manuscripts of the gloss, focus on is how one of the reasons that virginity is to be desired is that married people have such a hard time of making it. Just the penury that comes with marriage is, you know, you can avoid it, you know. And that seems to be the focus. It's not particularly praising virginity, but in the gloss as we find it in Lombard, that's exactly what it does, and that's how it comes into the Manipulus Florum, saying how, you know, this is the highest state that one could possibly attain. Rusch goes on to say how then there's this beautiful symbol of hyacinths that are the emblem of virginity and so on and so on and so on. Well, that's the kind of stuff that Thomas doesn't need to put into his Manipulus. It rambles on too much, so he cuts that out. Now, the text of the Manipulus Florum is not found in the manuscripts. In other words, it's this bit that we then find later in Lombard that is in Thomas and not in the previous manuscripts. Now, in a curious twist, the Lombard doesn't touch on the virginity issue at all in his commentary on this passage. He focuses rather on marriage and the virtues of a married woman, even if she's been married several times. And we all know that in the middle of the 12th century, marriage was a big issue. And Lombard was addressing it there. He wasn't talking about virginity at all. That's the passage, you know, where Paul is saying to his hearers that, being married is okay, but, you know, I encourage you all to be like me, and that way you have all your time to devote to God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In Doctrina Sive Doctor K, the gloss found in the manuscripts is replicated in Rush, but omitted in the Manipulus Florum, presumably because it makes no mention of magistri, as does the Rush gloss that does find its way into the Manipulus Florum, which is not to be found in the manuscripts. Again, this is one of those things. It's not in the manuscripts, it's in the Manipulus Florum, it's in Rush. Some things are in the manuscripts that do make it into Rush, but this one doesn't make it into the Manipulus Florum. We find in the Lombard all that is in the Rush text, and then some, which suggests perhaps that the Lombard's text was a source for Rush. I've not been able to find, I've looked at several texts when it comes to the gloss on Paul, and I have yet to find, I've not looked at that many, but of the dozen or so manuscripts that I've looked at, none of them contain anything like the full text that we find in the Rush edition. It's just not there. Okay. Now, in Antichristus X, we see the impact of the increasing apocalypticism of the time. The two short glosses of the manuscripts, and here I will pass out something. Two short glosses of the manuscripts are combined and tacked on to a longer marginal gloss in Rush, which is then followed by the gloss at 2 Thessalonians 2:4 used by Thomas. If you look at this printout, this is the lemma is in templo, and you can see that. Oh yeah, the fourth line of the biblical text from the bottom, ut in templo Dei sedia. You'll notice on either side of that line, you'll find glosses in the margin. Vel in templum quasi ipse cum sui sit, and so forth. To the left and on the right, id est ecclesia. Those are the two notes that we find here in the manuscripts. That's it. Now, interestingly, again, to give you some sense of how the Rush text is much fuller than that, you'll see how this gets treated and expanded in this portion of Rush. You'll see that the lemma is now the third line down of the display text from the top, towards the end, ut in templo de sedeat. And you'll see that there are two brief interlinear glosses above it, vel in templum, id est in ecclesia, vel in templo a Romanis destructo quatunc Judei redificabunt. Now, those are the two, essentially the same two glosses that you see in the manuscripts. Now, in the margin, you see on the left side there, midway down, in templo, the lemma in templo, and he begins with this, what seems like a repetition of one of the interlinear glosses, which, by the way, happens quite a lot, and gives the reference to Augustine. And then this, shall we say, longish quotation that describes in a general way the coming of the Antichrist. And then following that first gloss on this text, you have one from Haimo. Now, the Haimo gloss is the one that's actually in the Manipulus Florum under Antichristus X. It doesn't include this first gloss. It doesn't include the interlinear glosses. It really only has the Haimo text. And its virtue is, I suppose, in terms of why Thomas would have picked it, is that it spells out some of the nitty-gritty details, gives some meat to this description of the Antichrist coming, and how he's gonna, the Jews will all be converted to him, and they'll rebuild the temple. That, as you know, was the whole business of the coming of the Antichrist and trying to get all the Jews converted before the end of the world. That was a big issue for the mendicants in the 13th century. seems to reflect that, even though Haimo, I know, is from the 9th century still, they picked up on it. But it's not in any of the manuscripts. Those earlier manuscripts just don't show it. Now, in so we've taken care of this. Again, in Adventus Domini A, the manuscripts give only two brief interlinear glosses. They don't contain the long gloss that we find in the Rush text at 1 Timothy 1:15 that is the text that we find in the Manipulus Florum. And the Rush text continues well beyond the text used in the Manipulus Florum with an even larger dialogue, which, again, because it's citing a number of scriptural texts, he simply drops it. And here again, what we find in the Rush text, we also find in the Lombard. So not in the manuscripts, it's in the Lombard, it's in Thomas, it's not, and then it's in Rush. And it's Sacerdos D, again, brief interlinear glosses, don't find their way into the Manipulus Florum. Rather, it's a nice pithy quotation that Rush found in the margins, and it's not in the manuscripts, but it is in Rush and in Lombard. Well, after wading through all the weeds, what can we say about the relationship between the Gloss Bible and the Manipulus Florum? Clearly, the Gloss Bible was a source for Thomas of Ireland, and for the moment, the Rush edition is the best reference point for that. But there is a history behind the Rush edition, especially for the Gloss Letters of Paul, that is still not clear. Could it be that Thomas was using some version of the Lombard when citing glosses on Paul? Had the Lombard's work been excerpted and then integrated with the earlier gloss tradition by the time Thomas began to work? If the Lombard is the terminus a quo of that integration, although there is no manuscript evidence that it began that early, it would seem that Thomas gives a terminus ad quem for that integration, a work that was as monumental as the Manipulus Florum itself. Thank you.